a monthly podcast on the spoken word. Episode number 80, September 2024. Trace That Place, a conversation with David Crystal. Hello, Paul Meyer here. It's the start of the new term, semester, in the schools that use my textbook, Accents and Dialects for Stage and Screen. Thanks to all those theatre schools and departments that have used it over the last 20 years. If you're looking for a dialect textbook, go to paulmeyer.com/instructors for all the details on how you can start using it too. Now, guess that accent. Last time I played this clip from the Idea Archive and challenged you to say where on the planet the speaker grew up.
So I had this woman call me one day, and the phone rang, and I didn't recognize the number, but anyway, I picked it up. But this woman said, Mr. So I certainly could understand like where she was part of. She said that, do you have your computer on? And I said that, yeah, as a matter of fact, it's running, right? She said that, you have a problem with your Windows.
Although the speaker sounds Irish, perhaps the fact that Joel Goldies and I were talking about Newfoundland accents helped you guess that it was indeed a bona fide Newfoundland speaker, over 3,000 kilometres west of the Emerald Isle. It was Ideas Newfoundland 5. For the full recording and all the documentation, go to Accents and Dialects on the menu tab of dialectsarchive.com, then North America, then Canada, then drill down to Newfoundland. It was contributed by senior editor Eric Armstrong. Thanks again, Eric. Now this month's challenge. Where did this speaker spend her formative years?
Ida was born December 7th, 1982. I had two doctors and six nurses. And the doctor, amazingly, took bets as whether she's a boy or a girl. And out of the eight professionals, the two doctors and the six nurses, seven said boy, and he said girl, because he knew, I'm sure he knew ahead of time.
What's your guess? Get the answer next time. If you aren't listening to me on paulmeyer.com, switch over now. Select In a Manner of Speaking from the Other Services menu tab, then click episode number 80. You'll find lots of details about my guest and other relevant audio and video links. Not available on any other podcast channel. My guest this month is David Crystal, an old friend of this podcast, today making his sixth appearance. So welcome back, David, to In a Manner of Speaking.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
Fabulous to have you back. So Trace That Place. Trace That Place, nospaces.com. TraceThatPlace.com. The story and sound of place names on the road signs and railway stations of Britain. Your latest project. Fabulous website. Where did the idea come from?
Well, it was one of your good countrymen that actually prompted it. So imagine, this is about 5 years ago now. I've got a visitor from your good country and we're driving around. And every now and then this guy says to me, David, where does that name come from? And I say, and sometimes I knew, but most often I didn't. So I would say to him, well, I've got a book at home that could tell you. I've got lots of books on place names. Yes. And he said, that's no good here. We're on the motorway, you know. So I thought, wow, if only we had an online version of this that would fit into a mobile phone, a cell phone, so that we could just say, oh, let's look it up now. Dun, 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 dun. And there it is. Just short, succinct, to the point. And that's how it started. Yeah. And I thought, it's going to take just a few months. Well, in actual fact, it took about 3 years.
Oh, it's great. It's great. Why did you decide to delimit the scope of the project as, you know, road signs and railway signs of Britain? Just to make things manageable or?
Yeah. I mean, there are, of course, in any country, thousands and thousands of place names. You can't do them all, or at least no individual can. That's why there are place name societies. You have one in the States. We have the English Place Name Society in England. There's a Scottish one, there's a Welsh one, and so on. Most countries have got something or other. And it takes ages to cover all. I mean, the English Place Name Society, for example, started 100 years ago in 1923. And they've been systematically going around the country trying to record every place name. Now, place names don't just mean names of towns and names of cities. It's also, names of rivers, names of fields,
Yes.
all kinds of things like this. So it takes an age for a county in England to be covered. And they've done most of them now in 100 years. Not all, there's still some work to be done. And
Yeah.
so a poor individual like me can't possibly emulate all that. In fact, on the contrary, I stand on the shoulders of all that century of research that's been done, and
Yes.
a similar amount of work in Wales and Scotland too. So first thing was I restricted it to Britain. Yeah, that's Great Britain, not the United Kingdom. I haven't gone into Northern Ireland at all.
Right.
So we're talking about England, Wales, and Scotland.
Right.
And then the question is, how many place names are there that, well, why would people want place names anyway? And my American friend reminds me, it's when you're driving around or you're on the train and you see a sign. And it's the road signs that attract your interest. And not just the kind of, Nottingham is 20 miles away, but all these heritage road signs and these, special places of interest that people might want to go to. Or
Yes.
if you're in a train, you stop at a station and there's this strange name. So it's the signs on the roads and the
Yeah.
railways that I thought, I'm going to focus on this. The aim is to enhance the tourist experience, really.
Place names, it's just such a resonant field, almost magical, isn't it? You feel you're time traveling back to the very, very distant past, don't you?
Well, you are indeed. And there are so many of them around that I didn't, just a second, I didn't tell you the statistics of the operation. Even restricting it to the road signs and the railway station names, we're talking about an awful lot. How many railway stations are there in Britain? I can tell you the answer because I counted them. There are 2,576. All right. And then how many tube stations are there in London? I know because I've counted them. There are 272. So that's a start, just on the rail. In Britain, as you know, there are different categories of road. There's the motorways, the M numbers. There's the top class A roads, category A. There's the sort of secondary class B roads. And then there are an awful lot of roads that are not classified at all because they're so minor that, it's not worth doing. Yeah, how many were you talking about there? Well, over 5,000, basically. There are a couple of thousand A roads. There are 50 big motorways. There are about 3,000 B roads and so on. Can't do them all, of course. So what I decided to do was start with the most important roads, the motorways, then move on to the A roads and choose from there the roads that tourists are most likely to go down, roads to the Lake District, that sort of thing. I thought I'll do 5,000. And then I thought, no, a bit more than that. In the end, I stopped at 7,000. So there are 7,000 place names on the site. And that will cover, I suspect, something like, oh, I don't know, 60, 70, maybe even 80% of the road travel and rail travel that people make.
Yes.
So there's a limit to it. And in that 7,000, there are, as you were mentioning before, a huge amount of historical diversity.
So Google Street View and virtual travel plays into the Trace That Place story. What do you think of when we talk about that mode of travel? Because you and I are doing less and less traveling these days, but we can still travel virtually. How does that play into Trace That Place?
It was the only way. With all these 7,000 places to go to, we couldn't travel around all the roads for real. It would take a lifetime or more, and also not very sensible environmentally. But Google Street View is amazing. And so that's what we did. Both Hilary and I, my wife Hilary, we would go to the beginning of the A55 here in Holyhead, and we would drive along it until we get to its end. And every time we see a road sign, we would note down the names on that road sign. And then eventually they'd be looked up and the research done and the entry posted. It's not 100% perfect. Sometimes the Google camera gets blurred for some reason and you can't actually see the sign, the rain gets on it or something. Sometimes you're just coming up to a sign and, oh gosh, a lorry, a truck gets in the way, and you can't see the sign. And so you have to try and find some other way of doing it. The other thing to remember is you have to do each road in both directions. So if you're doing on the M1 from London to the Midlands, going north, you see a different set of signs than if you're going south on the M1. And so you have to do the journey twice. So that's what took an awful lot of time. But without Google Street View, we wouldn't have been able to do it at all.
Amazing. Thank you, Mr. Google. I was born in Wiltshire, as you remember, in a town called Devizes. Devizes Castle was built by Osmond, Bishop of Salisbury, in 1080. But because the castle was on the boundaries of two other manors, it became known as the Castrum ad Devisas, or Devisas, the Latin for the castle at the boundaries, hence the name Devizes. And you even add the detail that on John Speed's map of Wiltshire in 1611, the town's name is recorded as the Devizes. Ha! Who knew? Thank you, David.
That's the point. Who knew? The Place Name Society people know, and local historians in Devizes will know, but the vast majority of people have no idea what goes under the, what do you say in America, the hood of of place names. Yes, you're into history straight away. And notice, as in that example, you're not just into linguistic history. You're into social history, encyclopedic history as well. The two things are two sides of a single coin when you start studying place names.
So much information buried there, isn't it? Let's talk about the English place name suffixes. They tell us a great deal. Ham as in Chippenham, and Ford as in Bedford, Mouth as in Bournemouth, and Castor as in Lancaster, etc. I guess that's a question about place name interpretation. That's got to be a whole field of study in itself, right?
Yes, it is. And if you go to the annals of the English Place Name Society, you'll see there two volumes that have been specifically devoted to those prefixes and suffixes. They are absolutely crucial. Well over half the names in the country are there because they are compounds of that kind. Castor is a very good example. From the Roman time, Castor meant a camp. A Roman camp, a Roman station of some kind, Chester, as it would have been in those old English days. And because there were so many Romans all over the country, you get this Castor suffix all over the place. Now, once you know it, you know it. And that's the great thing about homing in on one of these suffixes. You find you're attracted to it by a particular name, say Lancaster or something, and then you suddenly find it's turning up in Manchester and suddenly you realize you know more about place names than you ever thought you would. Yes, Latin is one of the big influential elements here. Not just Latin, there are lots of Germanic influence of one kind and another.
More.
French, of course, very important in the Middle Ages. It's a real potpourri of languages when you start studying place names.
And lots of Norse.
You mustn't forget the Vikings, yes, the Norse too. The other interesting thing is that although this is a project to do with Britain, well, of course, you've got them in America as well. An awful lot of names traveled across the Atlantic.
All around the world, of course. Yes. And of course, British place names are prestige for new subdivisions and condominium developments in sometimes very, very odd ways. So what's the ham part of Chippenham?
Ham, meaning homestead or farmstead or village area. A lot of these suffixes have a wider range of usage than any one label can identify, but it's the basis of the word home. You see, ham becoming home later. And so it simply referred to a place where there was a homestead. But that homestead could, of course, have been a farm or it could have been a manor house. It could have been all sorts of things.
Yes. I was just in Fargo, North Dakota, where there is the Hjelmkom Center, which is the name of the Viking ship that that was reconstructed to cross the North Atlantic to prove that the Vikings did predate the Brits in coming to North America.
Yes, that's right.
Heimkomst, homecoming. Heimkomst.
Yeah, that's lovely, lovely.
Mouth, I assume the mouth of a river. I was brought up in my early years in Bournemouth. Mouth of a river, so that must be hundreds of...
Mouth in Old English, yes, that's right. You need names. One mustn't underestimate the mobility factor in the early English period. In fact, you know, this is for historians rather than linguists, but the speed at which the country was populated, first of all, of course, by the original Celts, and then in come the Anglo-Saxons, and they're all over the place in no time. So there was a great deal of mobility. And as soon as you get some kind of political unification, even if it's on a local scale, a local kingdom, and there were, you know, seven kingdoms in the early English period, then you need names. The authorities need names. The authorities have to classify things. They may have to tax them, you know.
The tax man.
It's always there.
Always there, yeah. I did a podcast with Graham Poynton. I don't know if you know Graham.
I remember Graham very well, yes.
Former pronunciation advisor to the BBC, episode number 64. He was consulted on how newsreaders should pronounce the place names in the news. He tells the story of a huge row over how to pronounce the family estate where Princess Diana is buried. This was at the time of the funeral, and of course, everybody needed to know how to pronounce it. The family estate, of course, is Althorpe, A-L-T-H-O-R-P, yeah. But traditionally pronounced, even by Earl Spencer himself, her brother, Althrop.
Althrop, yeah.
There was this huge row over... disconnect between spellings and pronunciations and local pronunciations versus outsider pronunciations.
Yeah, this, in fact, was one of the biggest problems I faced because people need to know the pronunciation. If you're driving somewhere and you're talking to your friend in the car or wherever it is, how do they say that name? It's surprising how many names are, in fact, contentious. BBC recognized this right from the very beginning. There are books on how to pronounce place names that go back to the 1930s.
Yes.
And then the pronunciation unit, as you say, tried to sort it out. Well, with difficulty, I found terrible difficulty at times trying to establish what the predominant pronunciation of a place was. Well, there are alternative pronunciations here. There's this one and there's this one. The Place Name Society records show a similar kind of variation. There are some place names where there are three or four or five different pronunciations. And it all depends on factors like you've mentioned, how old you are, whether you've always lived in the place, whether there are incomers here that are bringing in a new pronunciation that has become fashionable, and yes, all the rest of it. It's a can of worms. So how do you sort it out? Well, I do research. Now, you know what kind of research I do these days, Paul? YouTube.
Yeah.
And YouTube is an amazing source of fieldwork these days for place name people. Oh. It's extraordinary how many people have put up on YouTube a little story about their place, about their village, about their town, about the countryside they live in. There are millions out there now. And the thing about them, this is that they name the place in a totally unself-conscious way because they're talking about the village they know.
Yeah.
They're not interested in place names. They just happen to mention it.
Yeah.
So I've spent an awful lot of time going to these sites and noting the pronunciation that these people make. A very important feature of Trace That Place is that there's an audio recording of every name. And the story, that the devisor's story, is read by me.
Yeah.
And why did I do that? Well, because if you're in the car and the guy sitting next to you says, I'm just looking up this place here. Oh, here it is. What am I? I can't read it out. It's a bit awkward. I'll just press the button and you'll hear the audio version, you see, and it saves an awful lot of messing about. That took a lot of time, Paul, let me tell you.
I bet. So what are some of the most exotic disconnections between spelling and pronunciation that you've recorded on Trace That Place?
Well, it's It's like personal names as well. Sometimes there is just no correlation whatsoever. Here's one example. One of my daughters, used to live on the coast in Norfolk, in a little place which, when we first visited it, I thought was called Happisburg. Happis, Burgh. And any American would say it's got to be Happisburg or something like that, wouldn't they?
Yeah, why not?
No, absolutely not. It's called Haysborough. Haysborough. And you learn it by, well, I had a daughter to tell me, of course, but you learn it when you're driving along and you say, "Can you tell me which is the way to Happisburg?" And the guy says, "Where?" And you say, "How do you pronounce this place?" And the fellow says, "It's Haysborough, of course."
Wonderful.
There are so many places like that in Britain. Before I started to do the online work, I would use the telephone. I would ring up the this place and play dumb and say, "Hello, is that the Red Lion in, sorry, where are you again? Have I got the right place? Red Lion in." And the guy would say, "You mean in Haysborough?" And I'd say, "Yes, that's right. Hey, oh, thank you. Thank you. Where was it again?" And I'd get him to say it two or three times, and of course, write it down in phonetics while I was doing it. Spent an awful lot of time on the telephone.
One of the issues I got into with Graham Poynton was that sometimes there's a local pronunciation that almost is like a pet name of a family. And for an outsider to pronounce it the way the locals do sometimes is, in fact, presumptuous. Have you encountered that?
Yes, I have. And the Althorp example is really part of all that. If you pronounce it the way the elite do, then you're basically saying, "I am a member of your company," as it were.
Yeah.
And if you don't, then you're saying, "Well, really, I'm an outsider." And there are all kinds of value judgments of that kind that people make. It's a very common phenomenon, really. Everything is so mobile these days. The concept of somebody living in one place all their life and not
Yeah.
encountering anybody from the outside world is pure history.
Right.
First of all, most people move house. I don't know what the American statistics are, but there was a survey some years ago which showed that on average, people move six times in their lifetime in this country, in which case, you are bouncing about from one place to another. You're an outsider somewhere for a little while. And even
Yes.
after 30 years, you're considered to be an outsider still by the people who've lived there longer. And so
That's
there's
it.
an awful lot of that about simply mobility variation, age variation. The young people, they don't know how, in my grandfather's day, this is what we were called, you know. A good example of that is just north of Stratford-upon-Avon. We're not talking about Shakespeare today, but if you go to Stratford-upon-Avon and go a little way north of there, you come to a village called Wilmcote,
Been there. Yeah.
Wilmcote. It's famous because one of Shakespeare's relatives lived there. Now, how do you pronounce it? Well, anybody over a certain age says it's Wimcote.
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 Silent
Yeah.
L.
But
Wimcote.
if you're under a certain age, it's Wilmcote, of course. Now, the majority of people in the area are now under that certain age.
Yeah.
So the old pronunciation is basically almost defunct, and maybe it now is defunct. You know,
Right.
nobody uses it anymore.
And that's been going on for centuries and centuries, hence a widening disconnection between spelling and pronunciation, of course.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But we mustn't overstate this. We're talking, I don't know, I didn't do any percentages, but we're talking perhaps only about 5% or maybe 10% of the place names in the country. The vast majority are decodable and have a pretty stable relationship between sound and spelling. And more than that, one of the things, you know, when I started this Trace That Place site, one of the first things I did was I asked a lot of people what would they want to see on it? I mean, apart from the obvious, apart
Yeah.
from the history of the place name. And they almost all said, "Well, we want to know about the place as well. We want,
Yeah.
you know, a bit of cultural information. St. Albans, who was St. Albans then? You know, that kind of
Right.
thing." Suddenly I realized that it's not good enough to just be a linguist when you're doing this kind of applied linguistics, because remember, we're not talking about a pure subject here. I'm talking about making something that people would want to use.
Yeah, and I so appreciated all the photographs.
That's a big feature of the site. Pictures on one side. On the other side, there's a little map showing you where you are. Mm. And in the middle is the essential linguistic information.
The area of South London where I spent my teen years is called Southfields. No brainer there on the origin of the name or the pronunciation, but you do so anyway. Thank you very much. Fields, no doubt, lay between the villages of Putney and Wimbledon. Not a field in sight now, of course, completely urban. Oh. And I was just thinking, well, who named it? I guess it was named by the people to the north of Southfields, and they owned the fields to their south. So they called them our Southfields. But obviously the place lies to the north of somewhere else. Could have been ended up being called Northfields.
And there is indeed a Northfield.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So I guess
that's what people do. Westfield, Eastfield, Northfield. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes the words sort of collapse into each other. So the clarity of the origin is lost a little bit. But yeah, there is no great intellectual feat involved in most place names. Mm-hmm. You know, people look for the main feature that's in the area and they name it after that mountain or that river or whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. Or they notice somebody living there, so they name it after the person, you know, David's Place, as it were, and that eventually becomes Day Place or something like that. Most of the place names are really rather obvious, and some of them are so obvious that you can't believe the meaning when you encounter it. My favorite example here, I've got it on the front page of the website because I think it's so wonderful. Triangular Lodge. Hey, folks, when you get to trace that place, look up Triangular Lodge. You won't believe what you're reading, really. You're traveling through the Midlands of England along the road called the A6. And you pass a little village called Rushton, and you'll see a sign pointing to Triangular Lodge. Now, the etymology is trivial. It's a lodge in a triangular shape. But why? Well, it's a folly. It's now in the care of English Heritage. It was designed by somebody called Sir Thomas Tresham in the 1590s, Shakespeare's time, as a symbol of his Roman Catholic faith. And so what he did was he built the Trinity, exactly, with the number 3 dominating its construction and decoration. So it has 3 walls, 3 floors. Each wall is 33 feet long. There are 3 triangular windows, each with 3 gargoyles. There's a triangular chimney, you get the idea? It even has a linguistic dimension. There are 3 Latin texts, each 33 letters long, around the building on each side. Oh, I mean, it's crazy.
I've got to visit.
I never knew that place existed until I started doing this project. And that's the beauty, that's the joy of place names. The surprising discoveries you come across.
Of course, of course. So you live in North Wales, in what I've been referring to all these years as Holyhead. But I went to your site and it's Holyhead. Holyhead. Just found out that the stress falls on the head.
That's right, Holyhead. Or Holyhead, yes. I mean, the train is going to Holyhead. But you will hear Holyhead. Quite a lot around. Okay. What you will not hear is Holyhead, which is what it looks like. And that's the important point.
And that's where it comes from, presumably, of course.
Oh, yeah. Historically, it's a Holyhead land because a Celtic saint, Saint Cubby, was based here. And his cell was here. And his grave is thought to be here as well. So it was a holy part of the world. And then in the early Middle Ages, for reasons that people have still not entirely clear about, it began to be spelled Holly, and then you get Holly, of course, and that's the pronunciation that stayed. But the important point to realise is that this is, we're talking about the English name here. The Welsh name is Caer Gybi, meaning the castle, Caer, castle again, Caster, Caer Gybi, the castle of Cubby, Cubby's castle, Cubby's place, Cubby's fort.
That was the saint you were mentioning.
That's right. And this is a dimension we haven't mentioned so far in this chat, that the bilingual aspect of place names. So all the place names in Wales have to be in Welsh as well as English. Mm-hmm. All the place names in Scotland have to be in Gaelic as well as English. All the place names in Cornwall, don't forget Cornwall, have to be in Cornish as well as English because
Even
the
though
Cornish.
nobody speaks Cornish anymore, right?
Oh, but they do, you see, that's the point.
Oh, I didn't know. Has it been
Yeah, there's a
revived?
very, very strong Cornish language society group. People, I mean, lots and lots of people, they're so enthusiastic about trying to revitalize the Cornish language, which technically died out a couple of centuries ago when the last native speaker died. But in another sense, it never died out because, of course, it carried on in folklore, in place names, in all kinds of loose ends of ways.
Yes.
And the Cornish movement to get Cornish in the front of everybody's eyes and ears once again is very, very strong. If you go to Cornwall now, you will see the Cornish place name on the road signs as you enter a particular village and so on. Not everywhere, but it's sort of building up. In Wales, of course, it's governed by law. You have to have a Welsh and English sign side by side. So a
Yes.
very important dimension of this project was, well, I could do the Welsh naturally because Welsh is my second language. Cornish is fairly straightforward, but partly because there isn't entire agreement about Cornish pronunciation. And then I had to get a lot of advice from centres in Scotland to get the Gaelic right, because Scots Gaelic is a very distinctive form of Celtic.
Give us a Scottish Gaelic place name.
Where would you like to go?
Somewhere in the Highlands.
Yeah. So if you go all the way to the very north of Scotland, you'll come to the famous tiny place, the most northern place called John o' Groats. John o' Groats. Everybody knows because if you're going from one end of the country to the other, you end up in John o' Groats.
Land's End to John o' Groats.
Land's End to John o' Groats, that's right. And in Gaelic, it's three words once again, Tai, I, Ein, Graut. So Tai, Ein, Graut, Tai, Ein, Graut, Tai, Ein, Graut. Now, that's a terrible pronunciation. Most Scots people would say, oh, David, you're not got it right at all. I mean, and they give you a really good Scots, something like that, but I do the best I can. And so long as I'm giving a pronunciation that is recognizable, there are, of course, many Scots accents, as you know. And if I went for a particular Scots accent, other Scots accents would say, no, that's not right. Just like in any part of the world, the people differ in so many ways. So my version is a kind of underlying version of all these variations, really.
Nice. When you were working on Shakespeare's original pronunciation, reconstructing the sound of early modern English, were place names at all useful to you? I just looked up British place names that he uses in his plays. I was expecting a lot more, quite frankly. Lots of place names from Italy, of course, and other places, because he set so many of his plays outside of Britain. But were they useful to you at all in
No,
Trace That
not
Place?
really.
No.
Partly for the reason you say there aren't very many, and the ones that turn up all the time, like London, very boring. So it's not that much use. There aren't that many personal names either, really, when you start to look at it. But actually, this is one of the areas in the original pronunciation movement where there's least certainty. One never knows for sure exactly how somebody is going to pronounce their name, or for that matter, the place where they live.
It's a matter of their personal privilege, of course. You own the name, you own the pronunciation, right?
Exactly. I mean, you could call yourself whatever you like, Mayor, Maya, Moya. There are all sorts of possibilities. You've got the one that you use. And so we learn to respect it, unless we're taking the Mickey out of you or something.
Right. Yes.
And it's that's the problem with so many of the Shakespearean names. You're not entirely sure how they are to be pronounced. Tybalt in Romeo and Juliet, or Tybalt, or Tybalt. There are all kinds of possibilities. So you go for the one that you think is most likely. Sometimes there's evidence for it.
Metrically or with puns or with.
Metrically with puns, yes, especially with puns, but sometimes metrically and sometimes just from the spelling. But often you just have to say, well, this is my best guess. And that's why I never claim that original pronunciation is 100%. I always say it's somewhere like 95%, because that remaining 5% is usually to do with place names and personal names.
Interesting. So place names and personal names are the least promising source of historical linguistics in reconstructing now dead dialects, right? Probably the least of all the evidence.
Well, it is, unless you've got good spelling records. And this is one of the big principles of the Place Name Society I mentioned earlier. The chap who started it has a very famous statement in which he says, unless you've got good historical records, that means spellings and so on, your guess about etymology is useless, he says. And indeed, he's right. You know, fortunately, thanks to the immense number of pipe rolls and documents and certificates and things like that that have survived over the centuries, there is a great deal of place name information around, and personal name too, which is absolutely invaluable. And a very large number of the deductions one makes about early pronunciation is based on those spellings. So it isn't as bad a scenario as one might think.
Okay. But it's, and then I'm thinking that place names are more likely to survive in stone inscriptions than a crumbling manuscript. So
in the early period, absolutely. Yes, in Anglo-Saxon times, very large number of inscriptions, source of evidence here. But it didn't take long before the manuscript side started to build up, you know.
Yep.
As soon as the country started to become unified in some way, I mean, this is Alfred the Great talking 9th century, early 10th century. As soon as that started to happen, then we're getting an increasing number of place names written down. And then, of course, the important document, the Domesday Book, that is a major source of information. It's a bit idiosyncratic in places, but it did generate a huge number of associated documents, enough of which have survived to mean we've got a very rich database there for the early medieval period.
Amazing. One more place name before I let you go today. One of my favorites. I didn't know what the heck it was. Ashby de la Zouche. So I had to go to trace that place to hear what David had to say.
He found the Zouche name.
A Breton by the name of Zouche inherited the estate. It was Ashby, because that's where ash trees grow, I think.
Right.
Am I getting it right?
Yeah, and Bu is one of these Norse suffixes. Bu means, all the names ending in B-Y mean, you know, a place, a farmstead.
A
Danish settlement of some kind. And that's why you find them mainly in the northeastern and middle eastern parts of the country, because the Danes were mainly settled.
The Dane law.
The Dane law, yes.
What a concept that is. Wonderful. And Zouche, you tell us, his family name means stump. Well, that doesn't sound romantically French at all.
Yeah, absolutely. And once again, who knew, you know? I mean, some local people would know, but that's the fascination. I learned so much, and people will learn so much. And it's not just learning in a pure sense, it's fun as well.
Oh, so much fun. I've had hours of fun on tracethatplace.com. Thank you for creating it, David, and thanks for joining me again today.
Well, it's been a pleasure, Paul, and good traveling.
And thanks to you for joining me, Paul Meyer, and my guest, David Crystal. For extra information about him, lists of his other works, podcasts with me, etc., and other relevant material, go to paulmeyer.com, choose In a Manner of Speaking from the Other Services tab on the menu bar, and click episode number 80. Don't forget to follow Paul Meyer Dialect Services on Facebook and me on X or Twitter at DialectPaul. Email me with your comments and questions, paul@paulmeyer.com. I always love hearing from listeners. Next month, my guest is Jacqueline Springfield. Our topic will be Voices of the Civil Rights Movement in the USA. Next time on In a Manner of Speaking.